Hi, friends. Welcome to the By Faith Podcast. I'm your host, Christine Hoover, and I'm so glad you're here. Each week this season, I'm talking with a guest about how they're using their unique gifts and talents in their specific context and season of life. My prayer for you is that by listening, you'll be encouraged, challenged, and equipped to step out by faith using your particular gifts for God's glory. I'd like to thank my sponsor for today's episode, Baker Books. In Rebecca Friedlander's new book, Finding Beautiful, you are invited on a grand adventure around the world to discover authentic beauty according to God's vision. Rebecca, a photographer, speaker, singer, and artist, traveled the world with her camera, capturing stories of women who experienced transformation from brokenness to beauty by listening and believing what God says about their worth, identity, and purpose. Through engaging personal stories and dramatic before and after photography, Finding Beautiful empowers you to reject doubt and low self-esteem and instead claim confidence in biblical truth about your unique beauty. This is a perfect book for a sister, friend, daughter, mother, or anyone who loves an inside-out makeover story. Visit RebeccaFriedlander.com to learn more. Today on the show, I'm welcoming Carolyn McCulley to talk about women, work, and the church. Carolyn is a fascinating and incredibly smart person. She describes herself as a storyteller, and she's telling stories through documentary filmmaking, book writing, and speaking. I first learned about her several years back when I read her book, The Measure of Success, Uncovering the Biblical Perspective on Women, Work, and the Home. And I gained some really helpful insights on women and work. So in our conversation today, we talk about women and work and how we don't often talk about the entire arc of a woman's life and how this hinders our understanding of biblical womanhood. Carolyn also shares about being single in the church and gives us some super practical things we all can do to cultivate community for our single friends, as well as how we can encourage singles to use their gifts within the church. I know you're going to be so encouraged by this conversation. Here, friends, is my chat with Carolyn McCulley. I'm so excited to welcome Carolyn McCulley to my podcast today. Welcome, Carolyn.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
I'm excited to get to talk to you because, one, I was in a room with you this fall or last fall, and I never actually got to meet you, but whenever you introduced yourself, I kind of perked up because I have read one of your books and it really impacted me. And for some reason, I never made it across the room to speak to you and to introduce myself. So I'm excited to get to talk to you one-on-one today.
Me too. And it was a crowded room. It was hard to meet everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. We were there to talk about women in the church, in the larger church. What were your thoughts or takeaways as you left that meeting?
Well, you know, right after that, I scheduled a time with the elders of my own church. I attend a church here in Arlington, Virginia, and I wanted to sit and talk with them about some of the things I had heard. And I had the permission to share that with them. And I think much in the same way, when during our meeting, we had a time to brainstorm among women, and we also had the time to then bring in other brothers in the church and talk about it, that the same way as those brothers were kind of surprised by the reflections, so were my own elders. And I would say in neither case are these men who are disconnected. They're not purposefully overlooking the sisters in the church. It's part and parcel, I think, of living the world that we live in, especially the fallen world.
Yeah,
there can be a disconnect between brothers and sisters in the church.
That's surprising to me. I think it was surprising to me to sit in a room with men and for them to be surprised at what we were saying, because these are men that are very engaged in the local church and the larger evangelical world. I was very surprised that they were that surprised because it's just what we experience as women. We were talking about kind of our experiences, both good and bad, and how we hope the church can move forward. And a lot of these things, I think they had never thought of before. And that's what was surprising to me.
Mm-hmm. And yet you know, though we could be negative about that, it's actually wonderful that it was these brothers who had initiated putting the meeting together.
Right.
So it's a healing thing. I think it's great to be candid. I think it's great to be direct about these experiences. It's good to knock on the door of the boys' club at times and go like, hi, here's something you might not have considered. And I just think what we have to do is guard our hearts from impatience or anger. And I speak mostly, I'm preaching to myself as I say.
Yeah. it was a very productive meeting, I felt. And I was very encouraged to leave and felt hopeful about the future. Not only that we were having this conversation with men, but just the vibe in the room among the women. We were all on the same page across the board, and we were excited about how we could be a part of moving the conversation forward and encouraging other women to serve and to lead within the church. So that was encouraging to me.
It was encouraging. And I think that one of the things that was borne out where people were saying that when women want to use more of their gifts in the church, what they're not saying is we want to be a pastor.
Right.
What we're saying is pastors, elders, you know, others in the fivefold gift ministry of leadership are there to equip the body to do the works of ministry. We want more equipping. We want to see the entire body activated to minister. And this kind of American ideal of it's just the professional person that's on the stage is the one who counts is so contrary to what the Bible actually teaches. And so we have to kind of keep breaking through that. It's almost a uniquely American idea, this like professionalism that we create in Christian celebrityness, and we have to kind of change that culture. But at the same time, we have to recognize there's spiritual warfare there. The first attack was to divide men and women, and that attack continues. And so we have to remember that there's going to be tone deafness that is benign because it's like, I just haven't been paying attention. And that requires an active engagement from sisters to keep saying, let's not default to the way the culture creates us and creates the situation. And let's not default to sin patterns that have been with us since the world. Let's persevere in being brothers and sisters in the church. And that's really hard to do. Mm-hmm. And it requires ongoing generosity toward each other.
I love the language you're using is what we also talked about, the brothers and sisters, and bringing that language to the forefront, using that as we talk to one another, with one another. And I love that you're even using it there. And I think for women listening, they're probably like, oh, I want to be a part of that conversation. That's a conversation for another day. But I would love to hear about you in your local context and what you're doing, not only with the church, but in your work. So can you introduce yourself to the listeners?
Sure. We kind of got started with an insider conversation. I'm sure people are like, what meeting are they talking about? And you're being so vague. And yes, we are being vague for a purpose because it was designed to be an intimate conversation, not to be blasted on social media, but to jumpstart a conversation. So we're not trying to be vague booking or like, haha, we're on the inside loop and you're not.
Right. Exactly.
But, yes. I am unmarried. I don't have any children. I do have 6 lovely nieces and nephews that have grown up way too fast. And now I'm shorter than all of them and I can't believe
it. Oh no. Do they live close by or far away?
They do. 3 are in Virginia and 3 are in Texas. Well, actually one of them now is in Chicago and keeps reminding me that she's bought property there and lives there now. So I'm like,
oh my, she's grown then, I guess. Yeah.
They're all, more than half are young adults. So it's pretty exciting. I am professionally a filmmaker. I have, I think, been amusing God for the last 15 or so years by being in women's ministry. Sometimes I think that I joke around that God must have been bored because he's been hanging around for all eternity. It's like, oh, let's be amused. Let's save this one over here. Watch her.
What kind of women's ministry were you doing?
Well, I got started just speaking and writing about my background because I didn't become a Christian until I was 30. And I had been more of a cultural feminist, but I did have a degree in women's studies as well as journalism. And so I'd spent my 20s kind of absorbing the culture of the time. And so when I became a Christian, I was all kinds of confused. Like, what is this stuff about womanhood? And so after studying scriptures and thinking about this and studying where culture was, eventually I started writing and speaking on the topic and writing books. And I have never promoted myself. I've never had any strategy. People are always contacting me like, how should I become a writer? I'm like, don't ask me. Wasn't planned. It's still that way. I don't promote any speaking. People just write me and ask me to come. So I'm like, okay, show up.
But you said you were doing journalism before you became a Christian?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So writing is your background.
Writing is my background. Right. And so 10 years ago, I started a film company. And so I write, produce, direct, and edit through that as well. And also do occasional podcast producing. So basically I love telling stories in any format.
That's a good way of putting it. What kind of films do you make? Just documentaries or do you make more?
Mostly. I wrote my first short narrative script last year, and that was fun. I'm working on another one right now, but I find that real life is fascinating and yes, that it is, there are endless amounts of interesting stories, in some ways more fascinating than anything that I can think of, but don't say that to people because you're supposed to have amazing stories all the time in your head. But I think the amazing storyteller is Jesus, and his stories have stuck with us forever. And that model has been important to us too, as neuroscience shows us, to make empathetic connections in the stories and to impart eternal truth. So that's really what I hope to do. Although I do a lot of commercial work where I'm supporting my clients' messages, and I find that to be fascinating and fun too. It's more like problem solving at that point in storytelling.
Mm. So what kind of documentaries are you making? Or is it just a wide genre of documentary? Or
Yeah. Yes, it is. I just finished a short film last year. It's currently in the festival submission circuit, so we'll see how that goes. It's on the very light topic of a former school shooter. Yes, but spoiler alert, he didn't kill anybody and paid his debt to society and is now a believer. So he has a meditation on the reality of evil that I think is important for a lot of people to
hear. Is there a way for us to watch that, or does that, it has to be distributed after?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It'll be online at some point in the future. And so I'll be sure to blast it out. But at this point, it's in the festival circuits and you're waiting to see who's going to accept it for a premiere. So I don't need to cross my fingers. I leave it up to the Lord. But anyway,
what is the favorite documentary that you've produced so far?
If I have to say, I've done probably close to 200 client commissioned films, short films, and all of them have been fascinating because I've learned a lot about every subject. And I often get invited in to share people's deepest stories, especially when I'm producing films for ministry or nonprofit clients, because you're going into somebody's deepest story that they're trusting you to tell that's going to go out in public. And so probably the film that has gotten the most traction over the years is a story of a young couple who survived traumatic brain injury, and the story of Ian and Larissa.
Yes, I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, so that was one of the earliest pieces that my company did. And that I learned a lot from Larissa in the impact of what viral films can do to somebody for good and bad. When somebody offers you the tenderest point of their life and the online trolls come after them, it's a difficult situation. So I really feel the burden to tell their stories well in a way that makes that part of the reality of where we are with viral video worth it.
I never thought beyond that video, what could happen or how people would respond who weren't believers, especially.
Yeah. So. I mean, there was a lot of favor for them too. They got a book contract out of it. They began writing and speaking themselves. And then Oprah Winfrey's team had seen the film, and then they did an updated piece with them for her belief series. So there was good and there was challenge, but it just makes me more aware of it. And so, those are some projects. I'm also, in seems like perpetual fundraise and work a little bit and fundraise and work a little bit to finish other documentaries on equally light subjects like the high rate of medical errors in hospitals and things like that.
Oh, no. You probably have a mind that is curious about everything.
Yes. and retains random factoids, not enough to actually be helpful, just little bits of things.
I love documentaries. That's what I watch in my free time, like Netflix documentaries, you know, that's my thing. So I'm going to have to find all of yours and watch them. How would I find them?
Well, you will find them, the feature documentaries, when they get finished, Lord willing, this year. Pushing projects along, so humbling. The rest of them can be seen, the ones that I have online still are on citygatefilms.com.
Okay.
But yeah, it is, the independent filmmaker is this balance of hopes and faith and ambition with your own little projects and getting like in the face and you're like, okay, I'm going to keep going, push, I'm going to keep going. And then doing client commission films, which they are commerce, but they also are an opportunity to be a point of art. And I like the clients that I work with and I have fun telling their stories.
Mm. How did you get into all of this? I mean, going back to when you're younger, how did you get into writing? How did you get into filmmaking?
I tell this to people all the time and it sounds trite, but it's true. I discovered show and tell in kindergarten and I was like, rock on. This is what I want to do. I love watching people's reactions to things. Mm-hmm. For example, I just finished a series of films about children in kind of a low income area who had the opportunity to receive a scholarship and excel in places where they might have actually just been hindered by their educational facilities around them. And one's gone on to become a cancer researcher, another one's a translator for a Japanese game company and lives in Japan. And this scholarship opened the doors of many opportunities for them. Hmm. But what I didn't realize until we had the opportunity to show the parents a finished film was the emotional freight that went with that for them. One mom burst into tears with the first image and the first chord of music. And I'm like, all right, I must be really good. It was just like, bong, that was it, you know, and she's already crying. And I realized that her experience as she talked to me afterwards was, it was such a long, hard road to fight for my son, to fight for his education, to see him succeed against all odds in the violent neighborhood that they lived in, that the fact that anybody thought it was worthy to make a film about this journey just touched the mom. Mm. And I think that's my favorite part of filmmaking is when it's done, is showing people and watching their reaction. So that hasn't changed.
That's so great. I love it. I love it. Okay. Well, I became acquainted with you not because of filmmaking, but because of writing. You've written several books. The first one that I read of yours was The Measure of Success. And the subtitle is Uncovering the Biblical Perspective on Women, Work in the Home. And I loved it because you really blew up kind of these categories that we like to place ourselves in or other women in, the stay-at-home mom or the working mom or the professional woman who is not a mom, which we often don't even think about that category. We have the whole stay-at-home mom wars or whatever you call it. But the theme of the book that you wrote that's really stuck with me is that all women work. It's just we do different work. And that's been really helpful for me. I'm a pastor's wife, and as I relate to the women in my church, to think about each woman is working. How can I ask about her work? How can I encourage her in her work? And so I would love for you to elaborate more on that idea and the theme behind that book.
I actually got started thinking about this book. Maybe it was around 2010, but it was when microfinance was a really big deal and everybody was rushing to help put women in developing nations to work because the research had shown that women were very good with the finance and they would employ a lot of other people with their small businesses and raise an entire village up, etc. And I was thinking to myself, huh, so funny how there are quarters of the American church that tell women it's, you know, you shouldn't work, while at the same time turning around and putting women in developing nations to work. And I'm thinking biblical standards transcend culture. So if it's true for our nation, it's true for other nations. And so I realized that there's a contradiction there. And part of that had also been fueled by the research I did for my second book, Radical Womanhood, which was the book that I wanted when I was a new believer that kind of explained the assumptions culturally and historically that I had received through feminism. And then also you know, when I came into conservative church quarters, like why no one was actually laughing at what I thought were the punchlines in Ephesians 5, you know, like when wives should submit to their husbands. And I'm like, ah! Oh, wait, no one else is laughing. I should be very concerned what's happening here. And so I had to study hard to understand biases on both sides. Yeah. And I think I've experienced biases on both sides. I mean, I've seen where there is a limitation rather than a freedom for women in some quarters of some churches. And in largely that's based on historical ignorance. And I think that's the reason why I wanted to write Measure of Success, which by the way, was my pastor's idea. I had just started my film company and I was still figuring out things like taxes and QuickBooks and stuff that, you know, filmmakers are like, how is all this number stuff part of my job? And he said, we need a book that helps women to think about work and productivity. We were planting a church in a very urban section of suburbs of D.C., Arlington, Virginia. And so he's like, there are a lot of working, as we call them, working women here in D.C., and we have to think about this biblically. And so that's what got me started. And the point was that all work glorifies God. We were put in a garden to glorify God, to co-labor with him in his work of creation and blessing creation. And I think it's only really been since the Industrial Revolution, and maybe more in a pronounced way, since the propaganda of the 1950s, after we got out of World War II, that people were like, this is what our new normal looks like. This is what peace looks like. And it was all sold to us through national television and national ad campaigns. Well, at the same time, the reality was there were a ton of working women I employed in the workforce. And yet we started with this idea of living on a single income. And yet that wasn't the experience of the rest of humanity. And that's the thing that kind of kills me. I think if you talk to our ancestors and said, well, should a woman work? They'd look at you like, do you want to eat? Do you want clothes? Because those were the industrial sectors that women were in charge of. And we're always making food. Nobody ordered in, you know, if you wanted to eat, you worked.
Right.
Clothes, you worked. And sometimes that also translated into cash economies and cash crops. But a large portion of any family's household was based on what you could make, save, trade, or barter with somebody else. So always women were working. Yeah. It's just that the Industrial Revolution split apart the place of productivity from the home into the marketplace and separated these things and artificially created different roles starting in the 19th century.
So how do you translate that as you're speaking to women in your church or as you have opportunities to speak, how do you translate that to today and how we think about work as women? Because we still do have those categories.
Yeah.
So how do you translate that to women in the church today?
I think there was one legitimate and consistent critique of the book, The Measure of Success. It was that my co-author, Nora Shank, and I, we did not turn around and tell people, here's your prescription. Here's how to solve it. And we did that on purpose because the thing that I really and truly believe is that we're called to steward the gifts that God has given us. And those gifts can be time, talent, treasures, relationships, opportunities, capacity. And we're all very different. And if you look at it that way, I'm not called to compare myself with you or with anybody else. What has God given me in this moment and how am I to steward that in light of eternity? But because we don't do that, we also don't talk about the whole arc of a woman's life. So both cultural feminism, Christian feminism, Christian complementarianism, like all these different camps, they still are only arguing over the first 20 years or so of a woman's life. What are you doing between the ages of 20 and 40, essentially?
Yeah.
And we don't offer a perspective to women 50 and beyond. It's kind of like, see you in the great beyond. And because of that, we don't help women to think through sequencing, which was actually something that was raised by feminists in the 80s, and they lost that cultural war or conversation back then. And I wish they had won it because I think they had a lot of common sense. And that was the idea that men and women can't be exactly alike because our fertility windows are different. So the really truly radical feminist notion at the time would have been to say that's good and that women's life cycles should be different from men's. And there shouldn't be a barrier to reentry into community or the workplace or larger spheres after you finish rearing your children. But there is a very real penalty to that, and it still exists. And that's the reason why a lot of people are stymied in our conversation. So the one thing that I could offer is the Holy Spirit, who gives us these gifts, he knows what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And he can lead you. And that will mean that in some cases, some women will be called into careers where they are saving lives, they are creating something new, they're bringing something to the marketplace that is for the benefit of the larger creation. And others will be called to steward a larger family or care for elderly parents or whatever. We'll all look different. And if we stop comparing ourselves one to another and instead just say, what do I have for right now? And what can wait? Let me put it this way. What can wait until later on to simmer? So if you have writing or artistic gifts, theoretically, you get better at them over time. Greater life experience should make that gift better if you continue to simmer it. But you can't tell your toddler, hold on, don't grow up for the next 20 years because I've got something else to do. You know, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
That's a real priority. And it's a real biblical priority.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the most important point is, too, is we don't talk about capacity. Women have very different capacities.
Yes.
And generally, those of us that are on the women's ministry circuit, we're higher capacity, right? So we can make other women feel like, oh, I'm tired. I don't even want to look at what, I can't even consider this. You want me to do X, Y, and Z? And I just want to say, nope, some women have capacity to do a whole lot more, can handle a lot more stress. And actually, sometimes they're high capacity because life is smoother. Other women have more hurdles to cross. They have health barriers or issues with their families or trauma from their childhoods to process or whatever. So stop comparing yourself. The end line, the goal line isn't Instagram. It's not what anybody thinks of now or your likes or anything. It's that moment. I think if this is the one thing I've been given to like constantly pound is that moment when we see our Lord face to face, what will he say to us? I want the well done, good and faithful
yes.
servant. And it's good and faithful to what? To what assignment he gave you. That's it.
So good. And I know that people listening are just raising their hands, praising the Lord, what you just said, because I think we get so caught up in what's right and wrong. Like, am I doing this right? And so we look at other people and there's this mold, I think, that we've been sold that we all have to be, but some people are not, God has not given them what it takes to fit that mold. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't mean that he hasn't given them gifts, but some he has called to be unmarried and some he has not given children, and all of this mold that we have of this biblical womanhood
mm-hmm.
to do with it. I love what you just said, that it's what God has given you specifically. Are you faithful with it?
Right.
It's really good. So you've written about womanhood too. And I would love to know how you became a Christian. When you mentioned that earlier, I'm like, I have so many questions about this. Going from being a feminist to becoming a Christian at age 30, is that what you said?
Mm-hmm.
I would love to know about that.
Oh boy, it's a long story and I find it hard to tell it briefly, but the super briefest answer is the fact that my younger sister became a Christian in college and then just kept sharing the gospel with me. And I know she'd come over and sit in my apartment. It was like sitting in the bottom of an ashtray. I was like, whatever, you know. And I can remember driving with her and she had like a fish symbol in the back of her car. And I got impatient with somebody ahead of me and I leaned over and I beeped her horn for her and I flipped them the bird. And she's just like, I have Christian witness on my car.
Oh no.
By the way, I still don't have anything on my car because...
drive in DC.
I drive in DC, land of the impatient. Anyway, I thought I am working on it. So anyway, it was kind of a long, slow turning and nobody would have picked me at that time. In fact, after I became a Christian, my sister's maid of honor came up to me at her wedding, which was just a few months after I became a Christian. And she's like, wow, we prayed for you for all those years. I can't believe you became a Christian. Like, if you can become a Christian, anybody can become a Christian. And I just remember thinking like, oh, what? I had no idea that I was seen as so far out there. But the point was I traveled with her to South Africa. She was living there for a short period, attending a Bible college. I went to a church that was preaching racial reconciliation when South Africa still officially had apartheid. And that witness meant a lot to me, but it was actually hearing the full and complete preached gospel of Christ on Easter Sunday where I felt like the Lord was moving on me, and he sent a group of people to pray for me. And in that sense of having total strangers come up and tell you things that you, they should have no reason to know anything about you, that you realize, oh, yes, the Lord God, King of the universe, is speaking to me right now. His eyes are on me, and this demands a response. So I would say it was a slow turning. For a year, I was attending a church, and everyone was kind of confused about me. There was stories like, something Africa. I think she was a missionary in Africa. And then I would be in small group going, I didn't even know this book of the Bible was in here. And they were like, she was a missionary. What? You know, it was very comical when I think about it. But the discipleship of my friends then was really important.
So you talked about being a feminist, a cultural feminist, and then kind of having to think through what does womanhood look like according to the Bible. So I would love for you to tell us what you came to. I mean, you wrote a whole book on it, but yeah. can you summarize for us a good working definition of biblical womanhood?
I think if you'd asked me that question 10 years ago, I would have trotted out a great definition with great certainty. And I think now I have less certainty about the definition in the sense of what it looks like and more certainty in the author who created us, and more recognition that femininity looks vastly different than a lot of us would assume. And I think there's a confluence of factors there. There's the recognition that as we hear from different quarters in the church, people who have different life experiences, ethnic backgrounds, national backgrounds, that you can start to realize that there are some assumptions that are cultural in your definition. And it's also seeing that God works over the course of time in incredible ways. And if you stop anybody's life story at any given point, it's going to look incomplete. And without a whole long story on this, let me just put it to you this way. Before you called, I was actually meditating on the concept of Anna, the prophetess who met Jesus at his dedication in the temple. It says Anna was a prophetess. That's, you know, you stop. I've spent the whole past year reading through Luke very slowly, one sentence at a time. Because I'm a storyteller, I want to be like, let's move on. What's the point of the story? But scripture doesn't waste words. And so there's very specific meanings to things if you slow down and look. And I thought, Anna was called a prophetess in the silent period where God hadn't spoken prophetically. She was 84 years old. We don't know if she ever exercised that gift before she saw Jesus in the temple, or if she was called a prophetess and had to wait until she was 84 for the fulfillment of it, but then she saw it. And I think as I get older, I realize we compare ourselves too early. We have to run the race well. The finish line isn't the finish line until we cross it. And that there are things that God says over us that we may never see the fulfillment of until the end of our lives. And so that's what, I don't have the full picture of who Anna was. We just know that Luke paired her with Simeon, two people who would come in and speak truth. And Luke does that a lot. He pairs the stories of men and women together a lot for this experience of godliness. And I think now I would change the definition of biblical womanhood in ways where we can emphasize practice or preference. And I would say, like, use all that you have to glorify God's name. Look at what he tells you in scripture, what you have right now to invest, and run with it. Femininity isn't a certain kind of speaking style or what you wear. I can so remember these awkward moments in the 90s, which were just awkward anyway, but I had this great big Ford Explorer. It was black with red racing stripes. And I was like, oh, I have to be a church lady. So I went and I got this big obnoxious floral dress with these huge cabbage rose prints everywhere. And I'm driving with this ginormous Bible on the seat next to me, but I'm still speeding to get to church because I'm late. A challenge I still have. And the cop pulls me over and I'm like, okay, I got my church lady dress on. I got my Bible. But my heart attitude isn't like repentant. I'm just like, can you write that ticket as fast as possible? Because I got to speed and leave here. You know, I mean, so if he might have looked at me then and said, look, church lady with the floral print dress on and the big Bible. But my heart was still kind of chafing at the boundaries. It was chafing at authority. I was trying to get my own way. And so all of that is kind of this meditation that I was thinking on is the reason I think Anna was called a prophetess was because the whole sum of her life was pointing toward God's faithfulness and saying, I believe him. Mm. So that's what I would say now to women. And that there is obviously an expression of our belief and faith that will be different from men's. But I think there's a lot more freedom in that than we have often handed one another.
Yes. Yes. What are your thoughts about, as a single woman in the church, do you feel hopeful about how the church is relating to singles and championing, that's a hard word to say, championing singles and elevating them into places of service? What are you seeing as far as that goes?
Yeah, I'm now in a season of caring for my elderly father, and I kind of feel a little tapped out from the singles ministry is going on, you know? I'm in my 50s now, so I'm tired.
You do not look like you are in your 50s at all. I can
Girlfriend.
See you. Nobody can see you, but I can see you.
You're my new best friend, because I'm sitting here going like, look at these neck wrinkles. No,
I would have said you were, you know, a lot younger. I won't say a number, but I was thinking like, we're peers, but I'm not in my 50s yet. I'm in my 40s, but you look young.
Yay. We can still be peers. You can just let me like sidle in next to you.
Okay.
But anyway, so there are, I think one thing that's important for the church to know is singles, the life of a single adult is not monolithic. So to just say all singles are like this, I'm like, no, yeah. We have life stages the same as other people. So to be single in your 50s is very different from being single in your 20s. And so is your expectations and life experience and where you need support. But in general, even those of us who've experienced long-time singleness, it wasn't something we set out to do. I think most people we talk to are like, oh, it wasn't my plan. But there can be a good behind God's no. I have been spared a lot of trauma that some of my married friends have walked through, and I see that now in midlife. But as far as the church, there was a Babylon Bee article that came out a couple months ago, if you know Babylon Bee and its sarcastic humor.
Yes.
And it was a single woman gets married and gets welcomed into the real church kind of a thing.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yeah. It was funny and also really close to home for a lot of people. So it really depends on your church culture and context. I've learned this by traveling and speaking that people can have very different experiences, but I would say two things. One, you're dealing with adults who happen to be unmarried. Don't equate single with being immature. Or your memories of being younger, if you got married younger, just the way you were younger, it doesn't have anything to do with being married or unmarried. That was, everybody was immature at 19 or whatever. So recognize you're dealing with adults. Challenge yourself to include fellowship of uneven numbers. The coupling up of people doing things can be discouraging at times. And it also cuts fellow single adults out of healthy brother-sister relationships with the opposite side. I really miss having male friends. And the longer you exist as being single, the more you get segregated into whatever sex you are that, you know, I was going to say at that time, whatever sex you are, I mean. and so the idea that I can be friends with a married couple at a healthy relationship, that man is my brother in Christ, we have a friendship because I'm friends with the family, is very important. And to have men who are brothers to speak into my life, because men have different perspectives that can be so helpful, is important. And I would also say the third thing is, I say this wherever I speak, if you're concerned about your adult children or you're concerned about the number of unmarried people in your church who desire to be married, why is this one area we all just throw our hands up and go, I don't know. If somebody's homeless, we try to help them. If they're jobless, we network for them. If we do everything, it comes to people who want something that's very good in God's definition. We're all like, I don't know, good luck to you. And past generations didn't do this. They were very involved, and other cultures still are to this day involved in trying to find good and worthy mates for their children. So I say that married men are often the key to success. Please take the time to mentor young men and mentor single men. Get more men in the church so people can be married. You know, you look around and you realize there are a lot more single women.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is an issue. So it's a broad question, and I've given you like a splatter of an answer, but I think for those who are in the church, it's don't see your singles as being sidelined, but see them as being very key to your the spiritual warfare of the church and to the discipleship of others in the church. Mm.
So if you could give advice to a married woman who is in the church of how she could practically do that and not sideline her single sisters, what would you say?
You know, at that point, the married woman, single woman friendship, I would speak first to the single woman. What I would say is recognize that this is a woman who has her hands full relationally, and don't judge, but recognize that children's sicknesses and husband's demands and things like that will make a friend maybe a little less available for a while, but be there through different seasons because this changes. The preoccupation of a newly married woman or a woman with young children can make you feel like you've been sent out to outer space. Hang in there because your married friends need you. They need your life and perspective. And it's not just that they need your babysitting or childcare. They need that fellowship. And just recognize it is really hard and really full. And I know this because every woman I've known who was single, who might look at other married people and go, I don't know why they disappear, when they themselves get married, disappear.
Yeah.
It's a lot to balance the life of another person, right? Mm-hmm. And to coordinate all those needs, that leaves you with much less free time. Be patient. But pursue it. That's what I would say is pursue it, because we need that balance. We need not to be segregated by season of life. So adjust your life to whatever schedules you can to be available for family. So that's what I'd say first to the single woman. To the married woman, I would say is don't fall into the trap of what the culture says is you can't speak to somebody unless you've had that experience. A lot of married women will ask me, how do they talk to their single friends who are so bitter and consumed with bitterness about not being single and bitter toward the church because they feel like they can't speak up because they themselves are married? And I'm like, what you need to do is speak to that. You're the friend. Hmm. You're the friend, and bitterness is the playground of the enemy. Mm-hmm. And you who are married know full well that the romantic fantasies that single people have are not real. And you need to speak to that. You need to encourage them that it's a hard road of faithfulness at times. It's a hard road of leaning on God and trusting Him for your married life as much as it is for being single. And don't fall into the trap of you can't address those things simply because you have what the other person wants. Mm. Don't do it.
That's really good. I get asked a lot by, I have some really good single friends and I see them deal with this. And I've had other people ask me this, as far as just asking for advice. One of the things that it seems like that they struggle a lot with is what to do with their time, because they do have availability of time after work to give and to serve. My single friends serve so much. They are involved in a lot of different things. And sometimes it seems like they get overly involved because they struggle to understand or to know, when can I draw a line and say no, because I do have more time than my married friend who has young children or whatever it is. So what advice would you give single women who are asking that question?
You know, that is a fantastic question. And it's a great question to have as we're sitting here at the beginning of a new year. Because this is a time period where I spend a lot of time setting boundaries and goals, setting prayer requests, but trying to evaluate my time. And I'm not alone. I know everybody does this, but it's really helpful as a single adult to know what you're called to, because mm-hmm. not every opportunity that comes before you is something you should do just because you look at your calendar and it happens to be free that evening. That's not strategic living. And I was so helped by my first small group leader. She was also a counselor, and I think she recognized the fear of man issues in myself that I hadn't even seen yet, and my desire to people please and be like, yeah, yeah, my new people, my new community, I'll just do everything. And she pulled me aside and she said, you know, you don't have the benefit of having a husband in order to be able to say to somebody, you know what, thanks for that opportunity or that invitation. I need to discuss this with my husband and get back to you. Which doesn't, I mean, you can hear that sound like, I can't make any decisions unless I talk to my husband. That's not at all.
Right.
The husband should do the same with his wife. What it does is it gives you the opportunity to pause and reflect and think about, like, is this something I should do rather than being reflexive? And conversely, there are a lot of people whose first instinct is to say no, and they need somebody else to challenge them to do something too. So it works both ways. But in her case, she said, I want you to use me. Just say that you're learning to prioritize in your schedule and trying to figure it out in ways that are helping you to figure out your gifts and talents and where God's called you, and that you'll check in with me and get back to them. And she gave me that freedom to pause and think, and then taught me the difference between the tyranny of the urgent and the value of the important. So this is what I would say to single people. You, in some ways, have to do the work of everybody. You have to bring in your income, and you have to maintain your home, and you have to feed yourself, etc. And so in a lot of ways, it's twice as much work. But what you don't have is the teenager who decides to start talking to you at midnight, or the sick kid at three, or the husband that's traveling, right? So you don't also have the additional interruptions, right? But in some ways, you actually don't have that much free time when you think about all those responsibilities that exist right then. So I would say is sit down, especially at the beginning of the year, and say, what are my biblical categories? I am unmarried, but I am a daughter. I am a sister. I'm an aunt. You know, I'm a friend. I'm a member of a church. What has God called me to? What are my things that I'm called to invest? And then say yes to those. Because what you know you say yes to makes it a lot easier to say no to all the random things. You are not a human doing. You're a human being. And I think the biggest challenge for many single adults is being quiet with God and hearing from him. And I speak, you know, as the queen of the overly booked, that learning to rest is huge, and it is an important thing. Now, for people who are on the other side who need to be challenged, to be invested, that's the same thing as, here's my goals. Now, please come after me and make sure I'm doing them and I'm not just sitting in my house. I get different personality types and I get different energy levels, but recharging for either personality level is really recharging before God.
That's really good advice. I'm so thankful for this time with you, Carolyn. It's been so great to hear from you, to learn from you. Thank you for your time today.
Oh, I've really enjoyed it. I hope we can continue the conversation.
Friends, thank you so much for listening to By Faith. It is such a joy for me personally to have these kinds of conversations, but I also love creating them for you. If you're encouraged or helped in some way, I would love for you to share the podcast with a friend or leave a review. Thank you so much in advance. Join me next week as I talk with my fellow Charlottesvillian, author and pastor, Wynn Collier. Wynn joins me to talk about writing, how he got started writing, what he'd say to people who want to write, and what incredible project he's working on currently that I myself cannot wait to read. Meet me back here next week, and until then, have a great week and keep walking forward by faith.